Thanks very much. Let me try to get a sense for who's here. How many of you own your own businesses? Please raise your hand. Okay. How many of you are employed by family-dominated companies? In other words, one family or one individual really sort of owns most of the equity. Please raise your hand. Nobody?
What was that question again?
How many of you are employed by family-dominated companies? Okay. Okay. How many of you are CEOs? Raise your hands. How many of you are HR? Okay. Let's quickly go around the room. What is it you do?
I'm a financial advisor.
Okay. And who do you advise?
I advise individuals and small business owners.
Okay. Fine. So we'll be talking about succession. Leadership succession, and that would be relevant to...
And that's why I'm here. I mean,
How about you?
I work in recruitment and administration for a charter school network.
Okay. How about you?
I wear three hats in my company. I'm the executive assistant of the CEO and COO of the company.
Okay.
I do the human resources section of it, and I also do bookkeeping.
Okay. Great.
I'm a jack of all trades.
And how about you?
I'm the owner of Star Parking.
Okay. Is it a family business?
I guess you could say that.
Okay, all right. And
you're our director at the Eagle Tribune.
Okay, great. And how about you?
I'm actually the incoming CEO at YWCA Greater Ones.
Fabulous! Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And we know about Andrea, of course. Andrea and I go back to the last century. It's a long, long time. She is fabulous. She a fabulous HR person. This is an ideas to action program. So I'm going to be suggesting some things, and if any of you want to have up to an hour of telephone consultation for free to transform some of these ideas to practical action for your company, I'll be glad to do it. After an hour, then the taxi meter starts. But I'll be glad to do up to an hour after this program. We're going to be talking about succession. Let me tell you a little bit about my background. On paper, I am so impressive. I'm a licensed doctoral level psychologist from Harvard University. I write a monthly column for Psychology Today magazine called Platform for Success. We've got 80,000 people who have downloaded my articles. I am executive in residence at Suffolk University. I teach management. And I started my own company in 1979, so we're now in our 35th year. So we get involved with anything to do with talent management, leadership development, those kinds of things. On paper, I am so impressive.
And
because I've got this background in psychology and business, a really good fit for me is to work with family businesses where there are kind of complicated and convoluted succession issues. And it's a skill I have, and I'm really good at it. And of course, I can't apply it to my own business. That's where I'm not so proud of myself. So my story is, we start our business. My wife works in the business. I have one daughter, and ever since my daughter was little small, she would say, "Someday I'm going to take over the business." And my response would be, "Nothing would please me more." And so, time goes by, my daughter goes to school, someday I'm going to take over the business, nothing would please me more. We get approached by two companies interested in acquiring us. I turn them both down. I'm not going to screw up an opportunity for my daughter. Now my daughter has graduated, and now it's starting to get serious. So, based on what I know about succession and leadership, I say, here are the ground rules if you want to come into the family business. Number one is You have to start your career in an industry that has nothing to do with talent management. Talent management is my industry. I know talent management. You don't bring anything to the company if you're in talent management. You bring something useful if you come in with another perspective. Second is, whatever you do, you have to be successful. I do not want you to think that Stibel Peabody is your fallback position if you fail. That's not how it's going to work. I won't respect you if that happens. The employees won't respect you. The clients won't respect you. And you won't respect yourself. So you have to start somewhere else. You have to be successful in that. And then I know you're really interested in taking over the business. So if you meet that criteria. Well, my daughter graduated, went to New York City, got a job in media, loves media. She's now married to a lawyer who practices in New York City. Lawyers are not easily transportable from one state to another. She loves New York City. She's not coming back to Stibel Peabody. Now, so far, I've done everything correctly. I think I get full marks as a father for the suggestion. I get full marks as a businessman because the criteria that I set was the right criteria. I did the right thing. Here's where I really screwed things up. I knew this was going to happen 5 years ago. I knew that she was set. I knew that she was going to stay in New York. I knew that she was going to make a career in media. I knew this. And I've been paralyzed. I've done nothing about it, even though I've known it. And so how do you get... And that's my problem. So I'm here to say... please, I'm a very impressive guy. Please do what I say, just don't do what I do.
Well, you didn't have yourself.
Yeah, that's... I can't afford me.
Did you have an ounce of doubt that maybe she would come around and you didn't want to miss out on that opportunity?
I had some doubt, but it's still... I still consider it's what I did afterwards. Which is nothing, and that's very typical. In Boston, you know, many of my clients that in law firms, the specter that haunts them was a fabulous law firm in Boston that did a lot of work with high tech companies, and everything revolved around one person. And when that person died, there was this vortex. And the firm just collapsed, and your firm hired a number of those great people. This is not untypical. Matt Sonfeld wrote an article called "Family Business and the Relationship Between Business Age, Management Activities, Styles, Practices," and looks at four countries. He looked at the United States, France, Croatia, and India, and he looked at family businesses and succession planning and leadership planning and how effectively they do it. And then he looked as a function of, is it first generation, second generation, third generation. His conclusion was, basically to summarize, they all suck. It doesn't matter what country you're in, it doesn't matter what generation you're in, they all don't do a very good job on leadership succession. Family Business Institute. 88% of family businesses believe their businesses are in good shape as far as leadership succession. That's what they believe. The statistics are only 12% survive from the second generation family to the third generation, and only 3% survive from the third generation to the fourth generation. So if you're looking at
12% of the ones that are left at the second generation, only 12% from the first to the third.
So if you're looking at going from the first to the second, generally it's about 10% survive.
Okay.
Second to third generation, 12% survive.
So it gets a little better, interestingly, because they...
Yeah, it's more professional.
Interesting.
But third to fourth, only four. Why should you care? Why should an HR person care? One is from a CEO perspective or an owner's perspective, it helps you control what's going on today and to predict what's going on tomorrow. Second is, if you're in HR, HR is about one thing. How do we attract, how do we retain, and how do we motivate talent? Many of you are working in small companies with a dominant leader, and what is going to happen after that leader leaves? That's the thing that haunts many professional service firms. The topic that I have for today is called the Keep It Simple approach. I have in my file a very good HR book on succession planning called Effective Succession Planning. It has 448 pages plus a CD so you can print out the numerous forms that they have. And so sometimes in HR, you can get into oodles and oodles and oodles of complexity. What I'm suggesting today is keep it simple. This is particularly true if you are in HR. If you're going to be talking to leaders, you got to keep it simple. Now, if you have a piece of paper, I'd like you to take out a piece of paper and a pen. I'd like you to draw something. And this is like a 2x2 table. And so, you know, it's going to look like a cross. And here is one factor. And the factor is going to be urgent, not urgent. Urgent, not urgent. Then here's one other factor here. Important, not important. Important, not important. So basically, we're only going to be talking about two concepts. Urgency, yes, no. Importance, yes, no. That gives you four potential options, right? So when you look at your piece of paper, you should be able to see four gradations. Important and urgent, important and not urgent, not urgent but important. You see that on your. This was in a book by Covey on time management, but I think he got this from somebody else. But whatever it is, I find it an extraordinarily useful tool for me in managing the onslaught of information that comes to me. So let me explain how I use this very simple tool. There are four situations where information is coming at you. Could come at you in the form of a telephone, could come at you in the form of a chamber invitation, could come at you in the form of...
They're always important.
You
never see it.
More often than not, it's going to come at you in the form of an email. So the first is, let's deal with the easy stuff first. Urgent and important. You all know what's urgent and important in your businesses. You don't need me to tell you that. And when it happens, it happens. So I get an email that says, we've heard about you. We'd like you to come tomorrow because we have a need for this or this. You know, I don't need anybody to tell me this is important. I'm going to be there. I'm going to reschedule. That's important. So that's easy. Not urgent, not important is also easy, right? We're going to spend time talking about the Red Sox loss and why are they losing. It's not urgent in your life. It's not important in your life. If you got some time, that's fine. And if you don't have time, you move on. That's easy too. Here's the really tricky thing that differentiates success from failure. It's the other two gradations. The first is the urgent and not important. I find that when I try to go through my emails in sequence, in the order that it occurs, I'm usually going to fail my day. Because my emails are full of things that are urgent for other people, but not important for me. And I spend, how many of you are spending too much time on committee meetings that are urgent for somebody else but not important for you? And you can, in the absence of being thoughtful, you sort of naturally get sucked into these urgent and important issues. Urgent and unimportant. The last gradation is the what we're talking about this morning. Things that are important and not urgent. I understand it's important that I lose weight. I understand that. It's important I do. It really is. Is it urgent? Do I need to do it right now? And the answer is no. There are other things that I need to do right now. And so it gets deferred. And succession planning, leadership development, but particularly succession planning, is one of these characteristics that is important, but it's not urgent. And for those of you in HR, you can get so caught up in the daily firefights of HR, which are often the urgent and not important issues, that at the end of your career, did you spend enough time guiding your CEO on the things that were important but not urgent? That's really where the value proposition is for you as employees, for you as a consultant to families and business, and for owners. So if leadership succession, Testa was the firm that I was referring to. I knew Dick Testa. Dick Testa was the managing partner of Testa. He knew, the guy was brilliant. There's nothing that I'm telling you that he didn't know. But it was, for him, this whole issue about succession planning and leadership development was important, but it was not urgent. There was too many other things that were more urgent, and the firm's gone. So I'm going to suggest two things. One for owners of businesses, and the second for those in HR who are into leadership development and planning. Again, the approach is keep it simple. Keep it simple. First, at the corporate governance level, this is something that you're interested in. My recommendation is that the board instruct the CEO that 5 years before the CEO thinks it's needed, that someone be brought onto the board who is a true outsider and who has a mandate to not only be a regular board member, make a regular contribution, but be the corporate nudge on succession planning and leadership development. This has got to be at a board level, because unless the pressure comes in at a board level, the CEO is going to dismiss it. And doing it at the board level gives it that sense of urgency that the CEO will take advantage of, where if it comes from HR, the CEO can dismiss it.
Talk to the characteristics of that person?
Yes. First of all, a true outsider. Again, in many family businesses, particularly the ones that you deal with, the outside board member is my CPA, my lawyer, my financial advisor, everybody who has some sort of economic interest in preserving the status quo, or my fraternity buddy. I do not consider these real outsiders, even though legally they might be, they're not. So a true outsider is somebody that there's no relationship with the CEO, there's no friendship with the CEO. That's a true outsider. And this board member is said, you have to be good enough to be a regular contributor to all board meetings, focusing on strategy or whatever. But you have an additional responsibility. You've got to be the nudge to talk about succession planning and leadership development. Because this issue in family businesses is so sensitive, this is like talking about the dead baby in the middle of the party. Nobody wants, it's so horrible, nobody wants to touch it. Which is, you know, you're the CEO, you're going to die one day. And your daughter is, she really doesn't want to take over the business and doesn't know how to tell you that. You know, it's a hard, and people don't want to deal with that. So somebody's got to have the mandate, you're going to deal with it. You're going to bring it up. Second thing that you can do is make a recommendation that once a year, 1 hour a year, there will be a discussion about leadership and succession planning in the company. At a board level, he or she who controls the agenda controls what goes on. And often, it's really dysfunctional when you have the CEO who is also the president, who's also the chairman of the board. So if the CEO really doesn't want to deal with succession planning, leadership development plan, it won't come in as an agenda item on the board. If it's not in an agenda item on the board, voila, no problem. So there's got to be a structure in place at the board level. 1 hour a year, this is going to be the topic. And again, that's something HR can recommend to CEOs. It seems relatively painless, easy to do, easy to accept, okay. But it's important to create the structure at the board level. Again, my experience is when it comes to leadership development, succession planning, everybody's got good intentions. Everybody says the right things. It's the actions that are the problem. Let me stop at this point. Anybody have any comments, reactions, suggestions, or how does this work with your experiences? Anybody? Yeah?
Just clarify what you meant when you refer to the scenario or the outsider trying to get into the conversation. I didn't pick up on all that.
Well, what I meant was boards of directors. And by the way, when I talk about boards of directors, I'm also talking about nonprofits. Because many nonprofits really have very strong founders that started the business, or very strong CEOs that sort of dominate the nonprofit, and relatively passive board members that are, you know, they're there for the ride and they're willing to make donations, but they don't have an interest in rocking the boat or making waves. And so it's important to have someone who understands that they're on the board explicitly to be a nudge about this issue. Again, this is nothing unusual. There are people that are brought on boards and they're told, we want you to be a full board member, and the reason you also understand the reason we're bringing you on is we want you to be the chairman of the audit committee. So, you know, you'll be a full board member, but you've got this additional responsibility of the audit. In nonprofits, you know, we're bringing you on board. We want you to be a full participant on the board, but we also want you to be the chairman of the investment committee. And that's understood. All I'm saying with this is, we think you could make a great contribution at the board of the why. We want you on the board, and we want you to be the chief nudge on succession planning and leadership development. Because if you don't push, nobody else is going to. And we can't expect the CEO to be doing the pushing.
I would love to hear more about that. I work for an organization that definitely has the visionary founder at a nonprofit level. And while there is no intention on her end of leaving anytime soon, there is the thought that when we begin to have these discussions at a board level, we hear a sort of element of fear and destabilization that what happens when that visionary founder is no longer the head of an organization. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely an issue that's come up with our board in terms of how we think about that.
Yep. And again, the keep it simple approach is to have a commitment by the board that on a regular basis, we're going to have 1 hour of discussion every year. See, I'm stressing the importance of regularity and consistency and non-crisis. Because often what happens is if you don't do this, then when are you going to have this discussion? You're going to have the discussion in response to a crisis. And now the stakes are going to be extremely high. Whereas if it's known and it's in writing and it's planned for every year, 1 hour is on this topic, then it's a standard thing. It's not even worth making a comment on. We do this every year. Okay. The keep it simple approach is the idea is structure it before what we're really talking about here is risk management. And the best risk management is to structure things before you need to do them. And the worst risk management is to respond when you actually need to do something.
And just to clarify that, I was about to say before you said risk management that, I mean, really it's baked in from the beginning because none of us knows what's going to happen in life. But I mean, if you're, you know, 40, 50 years old, there's no expectation. And all likelihood, you'll still be around 20 years from now to run the nonprofit. But we don't know, right? So it's a good practice from day one to understand all the contingencies.
Right, which is why I'm saying, you know, again, using this the quadrant, we're in the quadrant called important but not urgent. And because it's important but not urgent, it can be easily dismissed. So if it's structured at the board level this way, that's going to help.
Not to be a nudge.
Bob, be a nudge. Go ahead.
I still don't think you addressed my question. I'm unclear on your scenario you were drawing with the use of the word outsider.
Yeah.
I need you to expound upon that.
The outsider should be someone who does not have a social or business relationship with the CEO.
And how does he enter into that situation?
You could.
What is that outsider's role?
The outsider's role in a board situation is to provide a degree of objectivity that the CEO may not be able to provide, and the nominal outsiders are too deep within the system to be able to rock the boat. You see this in credit unions all the time. Somebody may be hired as brought in as an outside board member, but after 5 years, they're part of the problem too, and their desire to stay on the credit the board becomes part of the problem as well, and so there's nobody there to rock the boat.
In a family-owned business where everybody from, let's say, the warehouse workers to my position, it's either referred by knowing the person,
Right.
How would you bring an outsider? Because there's a big trust issue there.
Let's keep it just to the board. If you're looking at the employee population, that may be fine. If you're looking at the board, you could use a recruiter. There are a number of recruiters that you can hire to find board members that really nobody knows. The other issue, and I'm a big believer in this, as a general rule, is term limits for all board members, so that there is an ongoing need to bring in fresh perspective and people. And by doing it as term limits, it becomes impersonal. I'm not throwing you out. It's that you had two terms of 6 years, and it's finished. We're having a party to celebrate your contribution, but it's over.
I'm assuming you seldom see that.
Oh, no. that I seldom see him? Yeah. Again, depends on the level of sophistication of the company, whether it's public or private. In many industries, it's relatively rare. In family businesses, it can be relatively rare.
Yeah. I went in February to a YWCA National Institute.
Yep.
And I attended a workshop on succession planning, and in that workshop, which I thought was really helpful. The presenter talks about you should have two succession plans. One is the one which is the one you plan for. It may be prompted by something in the contract the CEO or ED has. You know, give us 6 months notice, whatever. And what would that Yep. That plan B for succession. The other is the crisis plan, which they suggested should target every key position within the organization. And that's, you know, she said if someone gets hit by a bus, it's better to say someone wins the lottery. The unexpected sudden removal of a key person.
Right.
And that could be a temporary plan because the person is sick, is coming back.
Right.
And it was really interesting because it really looked at those two different plans in two different ways. One is where is the organization going in the future?
Right.
And how you continue to look at that on an ongoing basis for the CEO. And the other is, what would you do if tomorrow this key person couldn't come to work? And how would you function? And I found that really interesting, and right. I really hope to work on that. And we've had succession planning as a part of senior management for quite a while. But I don't think we really looked at the other as much. You know, we sort of will pick it up. I think that has to be very deliberate as well. And that's, I think, we're developing leadership. Because typically what you do is you bring somebody up. You know, so an assistant director perhaps steps in when the director can't do something in a particular department.
Right.
But that, I think, has a lot to do with building that leadership, building that ability to step up to the next level on a sudden basis.
Yeah. Let me respond to that. And my response is going to be focused on a keep it simple approach. Mm-hmm. Because the danger is you can get so caught up in the concept and agree with the concept, and then you start creating overly complex processes that then collapse on themselves, and then nobody wants to touch this again for 5 years. So try to keep it as simple as possible. Here are some suggestions for keeping it really, really simple. The second kind of succession planning, which is the unanticipated crisis, most of my clients handle it in the following ways. The CEO puts on a slip of paper who the CEO thinks should and could take over on an interim basis until the board selects a permanent CEO. And he shares that with the chairman of the board if it's separate. And I've seen this happen. The CEO will actually put it in a lockbox in the office and put it in the drawer. And the keys are kept at home so nobody can open the box. And then if something happens, the board goes to the widow or the surviving spouse, asks for the keys, and the CEO's wishes are there. This is particularly a useful thing in a family business. So at least that the short-term issue is understood. Longer term, a keep it simple approach would be as simple as this. There will be a policy that nobody from the company is to be promoted until that person has identified and trained his or her successor. In other words, if you want to move up in the organization, God bless you, we want you to move up. But if you can't move up until you have identified and trained your successor. Second, in a keep it simple approach, some percent, I don't care what the percent is, make it 2%. 2% of the bonus, 2% of the salary increase, whatever it is based on the manager has identified someone in the organization who could take her place, and the manager has trained that person. 2% of bonus. I once did a study looking at what are the high technology companies, the public high technology companies, that were serious about promoting women versus those who were saying they were serious about promoting women but not doing it. And it was relatively easy. We could look at the leadership, how many women, and then we could look at the compensation systems of these companies. It was so extraordinarily easy. In companies where where the women were actually being promoted and taken seriously, some nominal percent of the CEO's bonus was based on that. And in companies that just had good things to say but didn't actually do anything, the bonus system was based on just financial criteria like net income or shares. It had nothing to do with promotion of women. Now, this makes absolute sense. CEOs are really in the business of increasing their personal wealth. You know, you cut down all the crap and cut down all the public relations. It's about, how do I increase my personal wealth? And if the game is that I can get an easy 2% bogey by improving more opportunities for women, fine, that's what I'll do. And if the bogey is I get no additional money for increasing opportunities for women, fine, that's what I'll do. It's not, you know, business is not that complicated a game when you look at it that way. So if you really want to create opportunities for leadership succession, leadership development, what percentage of the managing partner's bonus is based on that chairs have identified their successors and chairs have plans in place to train those people? You don't do that, you're just talking. That's keep it simple. Put the responsibility for the actual implementation at the lowest possible level, but basically say we're putting our money where our mouth is. And notice I said 2%. 2% is not a lot of money. But it's the symbolism that we are putting our money where our mouth is. And that gets into the second plan, which is that the because then you're institutionalizing the idea that every manager understands that I have to identify and I have to develop my successor in the event that I don't have to get hit by a beer truck. I could win the lottery tomorrow and I want to buy in Ireland. It doesn't have to be negative. That is part of corporate risk management. I also think for those of you in HR, stop using the word HR. I wish HR was given more credibility. I wish HR was taken more seriously. I'm an HR person myself. God bless us all. But if you phrase this in terms of HR, it may not be taken very seriously. If you phrase it in terms of this is about risk management, which it really is. It is about risk management. Then you're more likely to be taken more seriously. It's about presentation, right? This is a wonderful restaurant. A mediocre dinner that is presented beautifully is going to be better appreciated than a beautiful dinner that is presented in a mediocre way. So it's about how do you present the issues to CEOs. Anyway, any comments, questions? How does this jibe with what your companies are doing? My prediction is most of your companies are not doing anything about this. And most of your companies just don't deal with this. And yet, it's a risk that's not being managed. Again, if any of you would like up to an hour of phone consultation to turn some of these ideas into some practical action, I'd be delighted to do that. Just give me your business cards. If any of you would like a copy of the MP3, give me your business cards. I'd be glad to do it. I have a PowerPoint presentation because the room was too small. If you'd like the PowerPoint, just say PowerPoint. Just say MP3, and I'll be glad to send that to you. But again, to summarize, we're looking at succession planning, leadership development in smaller businesses. And we're saying the idea is to keep it simple. We're using Covey's model, for there's four ways to look at something that's been thrown at you. It's an email, it's an invitation, it's a phone call. It could fall into one of four categories. In that four-category system, succession planning, leadership development, is one of those important but not urgent things. And in the course of business, it gets drowned out by urgent and important issues. How do you make it happen? Number one, at the board level, hire somebody with an accountability to be a full board member and to be a nudge on leadership succession and corporate development. This happens all the time at boards, again, with the idea that we're hiring you because we want you on the board, but you're also an attorney, so you can advise us on risk management. So you have, you really have two skills. We want you because you are a great investor, and so you can be on our finance committee. So this happens all the time. Once a year for 1 hour, it should be put in the notes. There will be a 1 hour discussion about leadership development and succession planning. If it's not at the board level, if it's not structured as part of the ongoing system, it's too easily forgotten. Then as you get down, and this is the second kind of succession planning, the unplanned for, one is the CEO put the name of the person who could become CEO on an interim basis in the event of the CEO's sudden departure. Put in an envelope, put the envelope in a sealed box, lock the box. CEOs are very comfortable with that. And they don't want anybody to know who they named.
Because in some cases that would be a controversial decision. I mean, if it could be I don't think it would be a controversial decision in some organizations.
In some organizations, it might not if it's clear who the successor is. It's not. Uh-huh. In other organizations, where CEOs are been known to play you off you, mm-hmm. if everybody knew that I've decided on him,
yeah.
You might decide, why am I wasting my time here?
Right.
So then, under those conditions, I want to put it in a lockbox. I actually worked for a company, it was an insurance company, and one of the ways that they grew was they acquired insurance company A, B, and C, and the CEO said to each of the CEOs of these companies, you're going to be my chosen successor if something happens to me or when I'm 65 and I have to retire, but don't tell anybody. It's you. He said it to three people. Those things happen. But the other thing is, again, remember, people are into their own personal wealth. I'm sure you would agree with that. And if you don't put some sort of financial consequence, you've just got a nice idea without any teeth behind it. And again, what I've seen is it can only, something as simple as 2% of a bonus sends a signal that this is important. Take it seriously.
Well, the other thing that's going on there, I'm conjecturing though, yep. That you hear the truth of the fact that people who write down their goals are more likely to achieve them, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
In that sense, but you said it's nominal, but it's the idea that CEOs are people who are goal-oriented people. Otherwise, they wouldn't
right.
have gotten to where they are. So the fact that you're giving them a goal, like you said, if it's 2% is, on whatever
yeah.
they're making, is that really what it's about? I think there might probably just be they've been given something and they want to achieve it. And yeah, there's some compensation associated too. I mean, depending on the CEO, there's a bet, which one is more important.
And using the Stephen Covey system, mm-hmm. I think the use of the 2%. And the use of, you have to write down the goal and discuss the goal, takes it from it's important but not urgent, and then puts it into the urgent and important category. Because if you don't do it, it's just a nice idea. And the other thing is, if you make it too complicated, it will fall with the resistance that you're going to get from a middle management and die. So you got to keep it simple.
In this small but eclectic crowd that we have here today,
yep.
There are both traditional corporations represented and yep. also nonprofits.
Yep.
Isn't there a difference in the parameters or guidelines that would drive succession planning, even perhaps legal parameters, as to who logically takes over in a nonprofit or who logically takes over in a corporation?
I'm not aware of what the differences are.
Well, for instance, within the chamber, we have several quote-unquote family-owned businesses. And one would tend to believe that those family-owned businesses will be steered in the direction of a son or nephew or grandson taking the helm. We've seen it happen with the DeLuca Motors.
Yeah.
Living on the planet today, there's William the Second, William the Third, and William the Fourth, and they're all still involved in the business, including William the Fourth will be spearheading the business, well, practically is in that role today.
Right.
Okay. Whereas for a non-profit organization like the YW or Class Inc. or Neighbors in Need, those lines of success aren't as clearly drawn.
Right, and often, particularly with smaller nonprofits, the ranks of leadership thin out very quickly. And there may not be any, you know, again, if the CEO gets the lottery ticket and decides to buy an island in the in the Caribbean, and they go to the lockbox and open the lockbox, there may not be a name there. And so the board may have to have one of their board members fill in on a temporary basis, or hire an interim person to take over the leadership of the nonprofit until a more effective search can be done. And this combines with nonprofits, you know, often lack financial resources to hire a recruiter or even pay for somebody to come in on an interim basis. So I could see it as a more complicated in the nonprofit situation. Which is why the issue of the board making it an agenda to have the CEO develop an infrastructure of people is important. Again, in an ideal world, if I was on the board of a nonprofit, I probably, and you're president of the Y,
That's the president of the YW. I'm going to be the new ED.
Okay, so you're the executive director.
Yes.
So I might say that 2% of your bonus or 2% of your salary increase is based on, have you identified someone to take over your job if you win a lottery ticket, and what are you doing to train that person? That's what I would do if I was president of the chamber. I would structure it in as part of your compensation package. As nominal as it is, it removes it from important but not urgent to important and urgent. But it's simple. You have to figure it all out yourself. You're not going to impose any names or any process. You've got to figure that out yourself. But you've got to set the structure. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day and a wonderful Memorial Day.
I'd just like to take a moment and talk about our next HR program. It will be taking place on the 12th of June.